Hello, I'm Dan Miles. This is number 0441, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0441. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, global adventurer George Karunas on some of his latest expeditions, including a trip to the top of an iceberg. Why did he do it?
We get these huge icebergs that break off the Greenland ice sheet, and then they float down the east coast off the coast of Newfoundland, and then sometimes they end up in the shipping lanes, like the Titanic. So I was on this mission. We were filming for a TV show, and we wanted to sort of track and see how fast these icebergs move. And one of the best ways was to climb up on top of one with ice climbing equipment and then place a satellite tracking beacon on one. And of course, the dangerous thing is these things weigh millions of tons, and they can flip and crack and roll without any notice whatsoever.
Gordon Van Gelder is the editor of Welcome to Dystopia, 45 Visions of What Lies Ahead. This is a sci-fi anthology that won't be a hit with Trump fans. The idea for this book was hatched on Inauguration Day over lunch with the publisher.
A couple weeks earlier, I'd been in touch with a writer, and I mentioned an idea I had to her, an idea for political satire. And she got back to me and said, it's a great idea, but I don't want to touch it because if I wrote it up, someone might actually act on it and treat it like a real notion. And I was saying to John Oakes, the publisher of our book, telling him this anecdote, and I said, you know, it worries me that if we're at a stage where writers are afraid to touch their best ideas because they're afraid that someone might act on it. And of course, it being Inauguration Day, the conversation led from that into, what if we do a book of stories about how sort of dangerous visions of the next few years? And he loved the idea.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. Book Banter takes up the mic and the brick wall too to look at the pioneering comedy club, The Improv. So I'm ready for my killer set, and that's coming soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0441, was Dan Miles, host of Friends of Dan podcast, and also Every Friday with Dan and Olivia, two excellent, excellent shows. Check them out when you get a chance if you're not already subscribed to them. And he's also an executive producer at voiceamerica.com. That's voiceamerica.com. Check out their shows. They have a whole roster of interesting shows. And you could also check them out in case you want to do a show yourself. There you go. Check those all out. You can find the links I just mentioned by going to the Stuff File program and going on the website to the number that Dan just mentioned. See how it all goes around full circle? Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much, Dan, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Here's an interesting skill-testing question for you. If you were a fairly recognizable child actor and you decided to commit an armed robbery, how long do you think you would be able to stay at large for? Well, according to California police, that would be one day. Former Disney star Adam Hicks was arrested in connection with several armed robberies. Hicks is suspected of committing three robberies over a two-hour period the day before his arrest with the help of his girlfriend, according to the Burbank Police Department. His girlfriend is also in police custody. Hicks, known for his roles in the Disney TV series Zeke and Luther and the 2011 movie Lemonade Mouth, is accused by one victim of using a gun to take cash, jewelry, and cell phones. Bail for the 25-year-old actor and singer was set at $350,000, and he was charged with armed robbery, which, of course, as you know, is a felony. Now, Hicks is set to appear in the movie Shifting Gears, which is due out in March, and is currently starring in the show Freakish on Hulu. Both of those titles seem disturbingly appropriate. No word on whether he'll be replaced in either of those roles by Christopher Plummer. Police in Mexico launched an investigation after a man hired strippers to dance for his 12-year-old son. Police said they launched an investigation after a video of the stripper dancing with the topless boy went viral on the internet. The boy, who was celebrating his 12th birthday, was seen placing his hands on the stripper's behind. The other stripper then pushed her breasts into the boy's head while his father laughed nearby. People at the party recorded the strippers dancing with the boy and caressing his body. At one point, one stripper forced the boy's hands onto the breasts of the other adult performer. Police are investigating the strippers for sexual assault on a child, while the boy's father might face a child endangerment charge. The father defended his action, saying he just wanted to turn his son into a man on his 12th birthday. Gee. On my 12th birthday, I was taken to an amusement park. An entirely different kind of amusement park. Anyway, it's time to share a story with you about a man who was done in by donuts. 27-year-old Bradley Hardison of North Carolina participated in the police-sponsored anti-crime donut-eating contest, despite the fact that he was wanted on suspicion of several break-ins. During the contest, Hardison reportedly devoured 8 glazed donuts in 2 minutes. Elizabeth City Police said that after making headlines for winning the contest, Hardison was arrested for crimes which he committed 9 months prior in Camden County. In that case, he received a 3-year suspended sentence. Hardison apparently did not learn from his mistakes, as he is making headlines over donuts again. However, this time, it's not over his impressive eating skills, but rather over his break-ins at, wait for it, a Dunkin' Donuts. Yeah, Hardison was charged with felony breaking and entering, safe-cracking, and larceny. Clearly, he has a thing for donuts, and donut shops. Oh, sure, he might be able to eat 8 glazed donuts in 2 minutes, but it's obvious that it's his brain that has been glazed over. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an escaped inmate in Texas is back behind bars after authorities caught him running back to the prison with a duffel bag of alcohol, home-cooked food, and tobacco. Jefferson County Sheriff's officers and U.S. Marshals were tipped off that inmates were escaping the federal prison in Beaumont, Texas, and crossing onto a rancher's land that backs up to the federal complex. The inmates would then pick up contraband that was dropped off by them and bring it back to the prison. Now, after authorities set up surveillance, they spotted a truck pulling onto the private property and dropping off a large bag. Shortly after, 25-year-old Joshua Hansen, an inmate serving time for narcotics charges, was seen running from prison grounds, grabbing the bag and making his way back when police arrested him. Inside the duffel bag, police found 3 bottles of brandy, 1 bottle of whiskey, multiple bags of Bugler tobacco, prepackaged snacks, and a large amount of home-cooked food, including barbecue sausage and fried chicken. Hansen is charged with escape and possession of marijuana. You know, this sounds like the plot line right out of a commercial for Bud Light.
Wait, so you escaped the pit of misery and you came back?
Yeah, with Bud Light.
That is the dumbest thing that I
ever... Oh, shut up, Doug.
Yeah, shut up, Doug. Dilly dilly.
Dilly dilly!
Yes, dilly dilly indeed. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Time flies. It's been about 3.5 years since we last spoke to George Karunas. He's a renowned global adventurer, storm chaser, explorer, and television presenter. He documents nature's worst weather conditions, and that's taken him around the world. Recently, I saw a picture he posted on Twitter of him standing on an iceberg. It's an amazing shot, and I just thought that I had to find out what it was all about, and also what else he's been working on. George is on the line with us right now via Skype from Toronto. Hi, George.
Hey, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too. Again, I saw that picture on Twitter. That was amazing. You were, I think, putting some sort of beacon device on this iceberg?
Yeah. Let me preface this by saying don't try this at home. we get these huge icebergs that break off the Greenland ice sheet, and then they float down the east coast off the coast of Newfoundland, and then sometimes they end up in the shipping lanes, like the Titanic. And so I was on this mission. We were filming for a TV show, and we wanted to sort of track and see how fast these icebergs move. And one of the best ways was to climb up on top of one with ice climbing equipment and then place a satellite tracking beacon on one. And of course, the dangerous thing is these things weigh millions of tons and they can flip and crack and roll without any notice whatsoever.
Wow. Now, is this, pardon my ignorance, but is this iceberg moving?
Oh, very much so.
And how fast?
Not very fast. They go with whatever the prevailing currents are. Quite frequently, they end up getting ground out. So sometimes they'll come into an area during high tide, and they'll get wedged, and then the tide goes out, and they end up stuck there. So we went at low tide while this particular iceberg had stopped moving, just to help sort of eliminate the chance of there being rollovers and things like that.
And how often do icebergs actually roll over?
Oh, frequently. As a matter of fact, I was getting ready to go scuba diving around one, I think the day previous to when that picture was taken of the ice climbing. And as I was getting ready to go in the water, pieces of the iceberg are cracking off with this tremendous thunderous sound and smashing into the water more, maybe 40 feet away from us.
So this beacon that you've attached to this thing, first of all, how do you do it? You just don't lie it on the surface. Do you drill down and anchor it in some way? What do you do?
Yeah, absolutely. There are these things called ice screws, and ice climbers, if you're climbing a frozen waterfall, you use these things to anchor your ropes. So I just used one of those, clipped it in, and we tracked the iceberg for several days. It was drifting around Conception Bay off of Newfoundland, and then the signal went dark. So the iceberg either rolled over or melted. It probably broke into a million pieces.
And what was the purpose of doing this? Like, what information do you find out about the iceberg or the flow? What do we learn from what you've done?
It was part of a larger TV program. It was an episode of Angry Planet that we were filming at the time, all about how climate change is affecting the icebergs off the coast of Newfoundland. So as the Greenland ice sheet melts, we're getting more icebergs that come in, and it takes about 2 years for an iceberg to travel from Greenland down to Newfoundland. And so we were flying with the Air Force, with the Coast Guard during their surveys of the icebergs. And so basically trying to learn as much as we can and to see how much the icebergs are changing, because they are ending up in the shipping lanes and they can pose a hazard to transatlantic shipping.
Now, every time we talk to you, we talk about literally extremes. The last time you were on the program with us, you were at a volcano, certainly a hotter situation than what you're doing with this iceberg. But you've also done a lot of other interesting adventures. You photographed the tattooed woman in Western Myanmar. Talk about that.
Yeah, that was back in March of the 2017. There used to be a tradition in some of these tiny villages in the hills of Myanmar where the women would get full face tattoos, and the patterns of these tattoos would change from village to village, and the practice was outlawed in the 1960s. And so the women who still had these face tattoos are now getting quite elderly, and this art form and this piece of culture is dying off. So I was part of an expedition to go there, interview these women, do a census of where they live, what villages they were from, the patterns, and photograph and do portraits of all of these women to sort of capture this culturally significant art form before these women literally die out.
And you also went mountain trekking in North Korea. I'm assuming the most dangerous part about that trip is being in North Korea.
What, doesn't everybody do that? Come on. Yeah, I've been wanting to visit North Korea for quite some time. And so I wanted to get in there before political tensions got too hot. And it just so happens that while I was there, I got up one morning and I flipped on the television, and they had launched a ballistic missile test the day before, not far from where I was in the mountains. And I was thinking, oh, please don't nuke North Korea. Wait till I get home, please. I've never, in all of my travels around the world, from Antarctica to the Arctic, through the Sahara, all in hurricanes and tornadoes, I've never really worried much about being nuked until this particular trip in North Korea.
Wow. Is there something particular or different or interesting about the mountain ranges in North Korea? Something you haven't seen before? Something unique about it?
Well, the thing is, very few people have seen these mountain ranges because it's so difficult and such a closed nation that we were able to go to places where very few Westerners have ever seen. And we were literally camping in the mountains of North Korea, which is almost unheard of. And so just by being there and taking photographs and sharing with the world, showing a piece of this beautiful country with people that are sort of being forced into this situation by this oppressive government, you know, there's a lot that we can learn. They're not all our enemies. Let's just put it that way. You know, they want the same things we want. They want to live a happy life. They want to their family to be prosperous. And we don't get to see that from them so much.
Is there or was there a lot of red tape you had to go through just to get in that country? Was that the difficult part?
That was absolutely part of it. Yeah, because I have such a history of doing television work and media, I was convinced that they were going to deny me entry or who knows what. But I was pleasantly surprised. The paperwork went through. We flew through Beijing. There are, I believe, two flights a day between Beijing and Pyongyang. And once we were in, of course, they went through all of our gear. They looked at all of our cameras, made sure we didn't bring any books in. So yeah, it was tightly controlled. We had we were watched by the government the entire time that we were there. And but we were able to get in and get out. And let's just say I'm in no rush to go back, but I'm certainly glad that I went.
I think the most telling thing you just said there was they wanted to make sure you didn't bring any books in. That's kind of scary.
Well, particularly Bibles and things like that.
Yeah.
They are very opposed to that. The most interesting thing that happened while I was there, we were at the top of this mountain where there happens to be a recently built ski hill, just by coincidence. And we round the corner and there's a group of 20 or 30 young children, age 5 years old. And they're singing and dancing and their parents are there taking pictures and they're all dressed up and there's a woman with an accordion. It's like a school trip. And then they invite us to take pictures with the kids. Okay, super friendly, really nice. And then 5 minutes later, they take out these plywood cutouts, these effigies, if you will, basically painted to look like U.S. Army soldiers. And then they gave the children these sticks, and the kids would run up and start attacking these U.S. Army soldiers.
Wow.
These kids, 4 or 5 years old. And I'm like, I'm from Canada. Just so everyone knows, I'm from Canada.
Yikes.
Yeah,
very interesting. And we just have about a minute. I started mentioning volcanoes earlier. You spent 7 weeks in Vanuatu this past summer, camped out at the world's most active volcano. Now, you see, that part doesn't surprise me because I've seen pictures of you doing things like this before.
Yeah, and I actually went back to that exact same volcano. I've been there. I've done maybe 5 expeditions to Vanuatu now, which is a small nation between Australia and Fiji. And on the Ambrum volcano, there is a pit that's 1,200 feet deep, about the depth as same height as the Empire State Building. And I did several trips rappelling down to the bottom on ropes to get up very close to the lake of lava, basically as close as you can get. And it is amazing.
I imagine it to be so. I imagine that enjoys pushing a grocery cart through a supermarket. That must be very boring to you.
I do it. It's weird because I'll come home after doing these extreme expeditions in these incredible places, living in a tent in acid rain for 5 or 6 weeks or 7 weeks. And then I'll come home and, you know, my wife expects me to do the dishes and that sort of stuff is normal.
Oh, please tell me that she gets mad at you for not loading the dishwasher properly. Oh, please, please.
Not so much.
Okay. It's always fascinating to talk to you. People can find out more information. They can go to your website, which is furiousearth.com, right?
Yes, that is correct.
And other ways that they can see the work that you do?
Just go to that website, and there are links to all of my social media there. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, the whole works.
And I will share that picture of you on the iceberg, because I think that's a fascinating shot.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on the program, sir, once again.
Cheers to you.
Adventurer George Karunas. Again, his website is furiousearth.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0441, and you'll find links to George's site. You'll also see that picture I mentioned of him on top of the iceberg. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. You know, the author of the book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Like the title says, within the pages, you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints up on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. All links are on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So, buy the book. What are you waiting for?
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the editor of the book, Welcome to Dystopia. Plus, Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, and lots of Stuff File news still to come here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And be a patron of the show to find out about our rewards program. There are lots of rewards awaiting for you. And those rewards include several celebrity interviews from over the years, some of them contained in my book, Great Conversations. So check them out. Join at patreon.com and you can actually hear some of those interviews that are in the book and many, many others. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Police say a fast food worker upset at having to work a morning shift has given new meaning to a burrito to go, slinging a hot one at his Taco Bell supervisor. Police in South Carolina were called to the Spartanburg Eatery, where a supervisor reported telling the worker to, quote, stop being a crybaby, just before being beamed with a food-filled projectile. A police report says the supervisor had turned away when melted cheese from the airborne burrito splattered her left arm, side, and leg. Gooey stuff also made a mess of the entire kitchen. Police say the worker didn't stop there, adding they were told that he took off his headset, broke it on his knee, and stormed out. Well, we've narrowed down the finalists for Employee of the Month, haven't we? Yeah. Now, looking for stripper poles, a coffin with cherry red lining, and a velociraptor? Well, you might want to check out the upcoming auction of gaudy items that decorated two mansions once owned by a former developer in South Florida. The Miami Herald reports the former estate of Thomas Kramer will be sold in one package to the highest bidder on February 14th. The auction followed the seizure of Kramer's State Island mansions following a judgment his former in-laws obtained against him. Kramer's extravagant South Beach lifestyle was fueled by the millions given him by father-in-law Siegfried Otto, a now deceased German businessman. Later, a battle ensued over whether it was a gift or a loan. Kramer lost the case, his home and possessions. Kramer, now living in Europe, is only allowed to keep his personal photos. You know, nowhere in this story does it explain why someone would have stripper poles, a coffin with cherry red lining, and a velociraptor as part of their decor. It will be interesting on Valentine's Day just to see the people who are making bids on these items. Yeah. 39-year-old Jonathan R.G. Carpenter of Drexel, Missouri, was arrested and booked into the Cass County Jail because authorities say he pointed a gun at a man during an argument. Carpenter was charged with unlawful use of a weapon while intoxicated and resisting or interfering with arrest. As I said, this took place in Drexel, Missouri. Carpenter is the police chief of the city of Drexel, Missouri, and was not on duty when the incident happened. Now, Cass County deputies went to the home in Drexel at around 2 a.m. in reference to a call of a domestic disturbance. The sheriff's office said a man there allegedly pointed a gun at another man. The man told deputies that Carpenter started a verbal argument with him, pulled out a gun, and pointed it at his face. The man also said Carpenter was intoxicated when the argument happened. It's unclear how the two men knew each other or what led up to the argument, which occurred at Carpenter's residence. Gee, do you think he'll still be the police chief after all this? I mean, the idea that someone can exhibit reprehensible and possibly criminal behavior and still keep their job? Well, that's just crazy talk. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 18-year-old Daniel Bennett of Irvington, Alabama, was charged in Mobile County with bestiality after engaging in or submitting to any sexual contact with an animal, to wit, in this case, a horse. The horse's owner, Francine Janes, and her husband became suspicious when their dog started barking the evening of January 4th. They found Bennett dressed in a trench coat carrying burglar's tools, hiding in one of their barn stalls. Bennett told Janes he wanted to pet Polly, the horse, but he admitted to sheriff's investigators he molested Polly. Janes said she suspects Bennett had visited Polly 7, maybe 10 times because toilet paper had been left. Yeah, the items have been turned over, and that's as far as I want to go.
The old gray mare, she ain't what she used to be. She ain't what she used to be. She ain't what she used to be. The old gray mare, she ain't what she used to be. Many long years ago. Many long years ago. Many long years ago. The old gray mare, she ain't what she used to be. Many long years ago.
You know, some people have to learn that nay means nay. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Gordon Van Gelder is the editor of a new anthology that I'm sure won't be a hit among the current occupants of the West Wing at the White House. It's called Welcome to Dystopia, 45 Visions of What Lies Ahead. It forewarns of dark days after the last presidential race. Gordon joins us on the line right now from New Jersey. Hi, Gordon.
Hi there. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Now, you have 45 short stories. I guess it's no surprise or not by accident that you chose 45 stories.
In fact, the publisher insisted on it. When I turned in the book, to be honest, it had 43. And he said, come on, can't you get two more?
So when did this all gel? When did you come up with the idea for this? And I guess the question I'm asking is, how soon after the inauguration, or was it even before?
It was inauguration day itself. The publisher of OR Books and I were just catching up and having lunch. And a couple weeks earlier, I'd been in touch with a writer, and I mentioned an idea I had to her that I don't want to spell out, but it was an idea for a political satire. And she got back to me and said, it's a great idea, but I don't want to touch it because if I wrote it up, someone might actually act on it and treat it like a real notion. And I was saying to John Oakes, the publisher of OR Books, you know, I was telling him this anecdote, and I said, you know, it worries me that if we're at a stage where writers are afraid to touch their best ideas because they're afraid that someone might act on them. And of course, it being Inauguration Day, the conversation led from that into, what if we do a book of stories about how sort of dangerous visions of the next few years. And he loved the idea, and it went very rapidly from there to a contract and then a full book.
When people think of sci-fi, when they think of dystopian storytelling, usually it's of a time period that is much further away from the current one. But that's not necessarily the case, and I would assume in a lot of the stories you have in this book.
Yes, in this case, I specifically wanted to focus on the very near future. There are only a couple that go farther than, say, a decade into the future. It is true, most dystopian stories historically have been set in either some far distant era or some indistinguishable era. I mean, if we think of Orwell's 1984 as one of the main works of dystopia, that was clearly set in the 1940s, but not explicitly so. And you could read it as a parable for being of almost any time. Actually, I take it back. It was set in the future, not 45.
Full disclosure, I have a friend of mine whose story is in your book. As a matter of fact, the first story in the book is written by Michael Libling. And he is a Montrealer like I am. And I read his story. And I gotta tell you, it sent a few chills because it's something that's close to a lot of hearts to anybody who lives along the border right across the country, who crosses into the States quite often to do what's known as cross-border shopping. And the story is entitled Sneakers. There is a little kernel of truth, I guess, in certainly in that story, and I would assume it's the same way with most of the stories in the books. So, bottom line, how much are you willing to terrify people?
I'm willing, personally, as the editor, is willing to terrify people to a great extent. Of course, it's up to the writers as to how far they're willing to go and how successful they are at that. But I didn't put any real restrictions on the writers that I can recall. In working on some of the stories, I might have suggested some changes that made things more or less terrifying. But I, offhand, I don't recall many of those. One of the things I was aiming to do with the book, and I think a lot of the writers were aiming to do, was to get just the kind of effect you described of someone saying, you know, this story reads like it could happen right now, and that's really disturbing. I know a friend of mine who's of, I think, Bengali descent, read one of the stories about naturalized Americans being deported, and he said his wife broke down in tears listening to the story as they read it over the dinner table. And he said it was just too close. To a great extent, the book, is a representation of the anxieties that have been going through the writers' minds during the election season and right after Election Day. And so if the book is successful at what it tried to do, it should touch a lot of nerves. It should make people antsy or terrified.
One of the things about entertainment, and I'm looking now from the comedy angle of things, there's a lot of comedy out there. The late night talk shows talk about the current administration, and there's a lot of humor being mined from that situation. And I find that some people are almost reaching a breaking point in that things that we would normally laugh about to a great extent aren't necessarily funny anymore because we're living through the reality. Did you worry or did you think at any time when you were putting this book together that while it's interesting to talk about some of the more odd things that's going on with this current presidency, that in putting out a book like this that we're reaching a saturation point of, I don't know if I can handle much more of this?
That never really worried me because anyone who's getting close to that point is under no obligation to buy a copy of this book. You know, we're not intruding into their lives. They've got to welcome us in by buying a copy of the book or coming across it some other way. In terms of saturation point, I think people will always, you know, everyone has their own level, and I think there's always concern about that. I didn't put it in the book, but one of my favorite lines of Oscar Wilde's is something like, if you're going to tell people the truth, make them laugh. Otherwise, they'll kill you for it.
You're the editor of this book. You do science fiction. Dystopia is right there in the title. Having said that, personally, how optimistic are you about the world in general and your country in specific?
Of course, it varies from day to day. I'm pretty neutral overall. About our country, I would be much more disturbed about the Trump presidency if I hadn't lived through the Reagan presidency. Most of my education, high school and college, was during the Reagan years. And to my eyes, the Trump presidency is like Reagan light. He's just trying to do the same things all over again. And we survived that, and I feel like we'll survive the Trump years. And I actually don't think Trump as a person means ill. I don't think he's actively out to destroy our country the way that some people portray him as. In terms of being optimistic, though, it's tricky because there's so many wonderful things happening. I'm leery of the term progress, but I think there are great advances being made in all sorts of scientific fields, and some of them are probably being sped up by the lack of regulations now. This is also where that Ray Bradbury quote that I put in the book comes in, where he said, I'm not trying to predict the future, I'm trying to prevent it. Science fiction has always had sort of both edges of that sword, that it's always wanted to say, gosh, wow, look at all these great things that we'll have in the future, but it's also always wanted to warn about the dangers of the great things that we might have in the future. And this book is really that edge of the sword.
As a form of promotion, have you thought of putting this book in the hands of many of the politicos who live within the beltway of of your nation's capital?
I've talked with the publisher a little. We've had a few ideas. We haven't acted on much of it yet. Honestly, I think that if this book, if we gave 100 copies out to, say, every one of the senators in the United States, I don't believe one of them would read more than a page or two of it.
Really? Even the ones on either side of the aisle, you wouldn't think?
Honestly, I think most of them would be too busy.
Oh, that's true. But they get to fly home a lot or take the train home a lot, so there's a lot of downtime where they can read this book. Have you had any pushback from anyone with the idea of this book? Because, you know, one of the things that's problematic is politics in general seems to be so polarized these days, more so than before.
I agree. I talked to one friend who saw a copy of the book. He said he looked at my introduction, and he said to me, I'm not buying this book. I don't want to look at the book. I voted for Trump, and your introduction says this is not a book that Trump fans are going to like. I'm not going to like it. I'm not going to go near it. So my introduction did its job. I did try to warn away people who are devoted to Trump. I don't think there's much in the book for them.
Well, if you look at the polls, according to this base, you still have 70% of the country to deal with as far as sales are concerned. So I'm sure the book will do very well. The book is entitled Welcome to Dystopia, 45 Visions of What Lies Ahead. Gordon, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you. It's been great.
Gordon Van Gelder, editor of the new anthology called Welcome to Dystopia, 45 Visions of What Lies Ahead. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0441, and you'll find links to George's site. You'll also find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. One of the most common complaints about the federal government has always been that Washington, D.C. is out of touch with the average American. Now, there's a movement underway aimed at helping federal workers get more in tune with the people they serve by moving their offices out of Washington. A resolution approved last year by a House Committee on Government Reform calls on all federal agencies to investigate moving away from the nation's capital. The Secretary of the Interior Department has already proposed moving the headquarters of the Bureau of Land Management, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Bureau of Reclamation out of Washington. The idea is to restore power to the people by actually bringing government policymakers closer to the people. Let's be fair, it sounds like an impossible plan, but it's gaining bipartisan support at some pretty high levels. While the sponsor of the plan is a Republican, it's supported by the governor of Colorado, a Democrat, who wants some of those jobs in his state. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, proving that a smile is just a frown turned upside down, here is Stuart Nauman.
Well, thank you, Peter, especially when you're telling jokes in front of a brick wall. Well, yeah, with the brick wall behind you and maybe a receptive or sometimes hostile audience in front of you.
Yes, it all depends on which way you're turned when you're telling jokes in front of a brick wall.
Yes. Never turn your back. Yes. That's for sure.
Yeah. Because if you turn your back, that's the plight of a substitute teacher.
Yeah. Yeah, think of all the spitballs, you know, projectile, you know, paper and paperclips that, you know, you could be a recipient of.
Especially when careful. there's a 2-drink minimum.
Oh, yes. Then you get the symphony of you sucks.
Anyway, this week's book is...
Well, speaking of that, it's a book about a comedy club. And, you know, what a coincidence. Well, exactly 55 years ago, Peter, Bud Friedman, a former advertising executive and aspiring Broadway producer, returned to his native New York City to open up a nightclub on West 44th Street in the city's Hell's Kitchen District, which wasn't far from the theater district, too. It was called The Improvisation. And his original intention was to run a night spot for singers, musicians, and especially the cast of hit Broadway musicals of that period to drop by after an evening's performance to relax and wine, enjoy reasonably priced food, and maybe go on the club stage to perform an impromptu or improvised set to entertain the audience in attendance, hence the name The Improvisation. The Improvisation quickly became a success in attracting everyone from the cast of the hit Broadway musical How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying to Judy Garland, Liza Minnelli, and up-and-comers like Bette Midler, to enjoy the club's relaxed atmosphere and maybe perform a number or two with the everyday pressures of putting on a good show, without them, actually. As the 60s progressed, the club began to attract another breed of performer, as established and neophyte comedians like Rodney Dangerfield and Richard Pryor began to perform at the club on a regular basis to try out their latest comic material. Now, by the 70s, the club shortened its name to The Improv, and they quickly became the place in New York for stand-up comedians of all stripes to hang out with their comedic peers and try out and develop their material and comic personas in front of a live audience. By the time it opened up its Los Angeles club on Melrose in 1975, The Improv and its founder, Bud Friedman, not only was known for being the model of the comedy club that we know today, but it also became synonymous with being a training ground and star maker for some of the greatest names in stand-up comedy over the past 50 years, like Robert Klein, Jerry Seinfeld, Billy Crystal, Larry David, Andy Kaufman, Drew Carey, Jay Leno, and Jimmy Fallon.
And I wouldn't be surprised if through what the work that Bud Friedman did through the years in popularizing stand-up comedy, that he didn't do a lot for the stocks of Zebrick.
Yeah. And the people who make the, you know, the mortar that holds those bricks together.
Yeah.
Well, I guess with Zebrick, you just peel and stick. That's all you do.
Yeah.
Now, Friedman, Zebrick or not, he gathered 55 years of memories, successes, setbacks, and discoveries in the stand-up comedy world and has put together a memoir/oral history that's just as entertaining as the comedians who performed in front of the Zebrick wall of its New York and Los Angeles locations. And the book is called, funnily enough, The Improv. Now, Friedman tells a story about the ups and downs of running such a legendary comedy club, but what gives this book so much balance and credence is that it allows the people who worked behind the scenes and the comedians who performed on stage the opportunity to tell their side of the story of the improv. And what an impressive array of people who were interviewed for this book. I mean, besides the aforementioned people I mentioned just a few minutes ago, we get to hear from Judd Apatow, Bill Maher, Bob Saget, Chris Albrecht, who started off working at the Improv and then became the head of HBO, Jimmy Walker, Paul Provenza, Danny Aiello, who started off as a bouncer at the club, David Steinberg, and Jerry Stiller, amongst many others. And what stories that are told in this book.
Wow.
For example, Rodney Dangerfield was an improv fixture during the 60s, even after he opened his own club in 1969, Bud allowing a young Jay Leno to be a regular at his club after he found out that he commuted from Boston to New York three times in a row so that he could perform there. Friedman's early recognition of the unorthodox comic genius of the late Andy Kaufman and Robin Williams, the tragic comic legacy of Freddie Prinze, Larry David's rather erratic comic persona, in which he, at one time, he went on stage, surveyed that night's audience, and said, no, this isn't going to work for me, and promptly left the stage. And then there's always Friedman's intense rivalry with dictatorial comedy store owner Mitzi Shore. And, talk about heated. Now,
so what you're saying is that Pauly Shore never was on the stages of the improv?
Say the least.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. That wouldn't... I think Mitzi would have disowned him if that was the case.
Yeah.
Now, although Bud sold the Hollywood Improv Club several years ago and the original New York Club closed its doors back in 1992, Friedman is basically retired from the highly pressurized world of running a pioneering comedy club. But he's given comedy fans a terrific record of his contribution to the world of modern stand-up comedy with this book, The Improv. It's a highly enjoyable look at a man who wanted to be a big-time Broadway impresario but ended up being present at the creation of the stand-up comedy revolution, and through the improv was a witness and driving force to the evolution of this entertainment genre and the places we go to in order to appreciate it.
And the book again is?
It's called The Improv by Bud Friedman. It's published by Ben Bella Books. It's a publishing company based out of Dallas, and it's $33.99.
And what other collection of stories do you recommend?
Well, I mean, there's so many books on stand-up comedy that's come out over the past 10 years. But the two I recommend highly is one that was called Comedy on the Edge by Jeffrey Zoglin, which is probably one of the first books in about over 30 years to look at the history of stand-up comedy during the 70s and 80s. Excellent book. Long time coming, too. And also, Jeffrey Gurian, if you know Jeffrey Gurian.
Oh, yeah.
Who's a comedy wunderkind. And all-around great expert and broadcaster and author. He wrote a book a few years ago, about 5-6 years ago, about the history of the comic strip.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, and basically he used his interview prowess to talk to those comics of what it was like to, you know, perform there and, you know, get your, you know, develop your comedy chops at this other New York comedy institution. The other one being also Catch a Rising Star. But
excellent.
Jeffrey focuses on the comic strip.
Excellent. Excellent. So again, this week's book is?
It's called The Improv by Bud Friedman, published by Ben Bella Books, and it's $33.99.
And how do we find you?
Well, not on the stage of The Improv or the Comedy Store. You can find me in the pages of the Montreal Times, where one of my most recent columns, Peter, I mentioned in one of my list of favorite books of 2017, your book, Great Conversations.
Ah, thank you very much, sir. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
You're very welcome. And if you want to read that column or my review of this book, you can read it also in the pages of the Times, online or in print, but online too at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter. And did I tell you the one about airplanes and peanuts and all that stuff?
You're here all week. Don't forget to tip the waitresses.
Yes. Thank you. You've been a wonderful audience.
Stuart Noman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you right here, right now. And, of course, an idiot of the day coming your way. Stick around for that. 30-year-old Elise H. Davenport and 27-year-old Deron Conyers of Southbridge, Massachusetts, couldn't make it to the funeral of Audra Johnson, that's Davenport's mother, on January the 5th, because they were busy stealing from Johnson's home. Southbridge police started searching for the pair after Johnson's boyfriend discovered the safe was missing. When police stopped Davenport the next day, they found the safe in the trunk of the car she was driving. A car, by the way, also registered to Johnson, and they seized it. Davenport and Conyers were arrested at the Sturbridge Motel, where officers found jewelry, keys, cell phones, and other documents. And the two were charged with 7 counts related to the theft. Davenport has a history of larceny, identity theft, and forgery, the police report said. Well, I guess she's really out of the will now, huh? An unnamed Russian man, apparently desperate for a drink, stole an armored personnel carrier from a secured facility on January the 10th and used it to ram a storefront in Apatiti, Russia. Surveillance video showed him climbing out of the tank-like carrier and into the store, where he retrieved a bottle of wine, then returned to the vehicle and rammed the storefront again as several bystanders looked on.
He took just one bottle? That's it?
After all that? Anyway, he was arrested after leaving the scene. You, my friend, have a serious drinking problem if you need a tank to procure your thirst quencher. And police in Troy, Michigan, got 2 calls that seemed to go quite well together. The first was from officials at the Zion Church reporting someone had shot out at one of the windows with a gun. According to Captain Bob Redmond, shortly after that, a man called to report that the Zion Church is an alien spaceship for reptiles. The main church building is a giant dome. Officers went to the man's home and arrested him. Police tried to reassure other churches in the area. We have absolutely no reason to believe this individual targeted this church because it was a church or he had a beef against Christians, according to Sergeant Megan Lehman. Rather, she theorized, mental health could be an issue here. You know, even if you thought it was an alien spaceship, what could you possibly think shooting at it would accomplish? That's just weird on so many levels. But since mental health is an issue here, or at least potentially an issue here, that's not somebody I would clarify or quantify as being the idiot of the day. However, this next story does fit the bill. Yes, boys and girls, it's time for that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time once again for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
Oliver Montgomery's job was to help clients get their Social Security payments. Instead, he stole from them. More than $37,000 in all. Montgomery has been charged with theft of government money and aggravated identity theft. He allegedly committed the crimes while on the taxpayer's dole. Montgomery worked as a service representative in the Charlotte, North Carolina office of the Social Security Administration. Montgomery's scheme covered a 12-month period that ended in August, during which he allegedly diverted tens of thousands of dollars from 2 Social Security beneficiaries. In one of the cases, Montgomery actually assisted his own investigation. After threatening an ex-girlfriend who planned to take him to court over a previous debt, Montgomery shot her a text message with a selfie that he had taken at the Social Security office. In the photograph, Montgomery posed with a large amount of cash, and he texted to his ex-girlfriend, "Show them that stack on my desk." Yeah. Instead, she eventually shared the text with federal officials. This is just the latest case of someone who is done in by a selfie. But you know, I have to ask the question. I mean, why? Oh, why? Would you take a selfie of your ill-gotten gains and send that picture to an ex-girlfriend as a taunt when you already owe her money? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0441. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0441. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Evolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.